The following presentation is brought to you by Priority One.
Good evening. Welcome to the second evening of our Strengthening Emuna series. Before I introduce this evening's speaker, just like to, since I believe we have a number of principals here, we have next week on Tuesday, December 9th, a different type, but the same idea, strengthening emunah in the home for parents. And there are flyers over here for anyone who wants to take them, make a copy, give them out to parents. You might find this December 9th at the Amizal of Midwood. So this is the flyers, here. It's an honor and a pleasure to introduce this evening's speaker. Rabbi David Saperman from Toronto, came specially from Toronto, is, in my opinion, a very unique individual. He is probably one of the staunchest advocates and maybe earliest is a hard word to defend, but early pioneers in the realization of the importance of strengthening Emuna in the minds and hearts of our own Hamish children. Not until recently was it realized the extent of the issues that our own children, our own Talmidim and Talmidos have, sometimes festering deep within inside, sometimes close to the surface, and oftentimes quietly articulated, but most likely afraid to speak openly about. Rabbi Saperman has done some pioneering work in this area, and it's really an honor and a privilege to have him here this evening. Rabbi David Saperman.
Thank you very much. Those of you who are following on the outline, I'm going to start from the bottom of the first page. I'm going to start from the bottom of the first page. It's not a simple thing for me to come here and speak to Choshev and Mechanchem and Mechanchos and tell them my opinions, my methodology, and Chas V'Shalem. I don't mean to say Kablu Daiti and this is the way, but I do want to share with you some thoughts and some concepts that I've worked on and thought on over the years. The purpose of tonight's session is to give over a few basic rules about how to transmit emuna. And based on these rules, we will give some examples of how to present a number of emuna issues. There are actually two different types of emunah that have to be taught to the children. First of all, they have to be familiar with what is the emunah of Klal Yisrael. What do we believe? What has been the emunah of Avos Aviseinu, Mimos Olam? From the earliest times, what do we believe in? And they have to hear this, just like we tell the little children that there's Hashem. And as they grow older, we tell them more and more. They have to hear from us what it is that we believe in. It should never be taken for granted. We'll talk more about that. But it should never be taken for granted that they know it, because if we don't tell it to them, they don't know it. So they have to know what it is we believe in. And this, at an early age, is the substantiation of this is only what we call behavloa. It just sort of gets interwoven without ever asking any questions, but we sort of weave into our presentation of the emunah how, as we will see, Be'ezus Hashem, how striking it is that we see the evidence of a Ribbono Shel Olam, what a wonderful Messiah we have from the earliest days. And that has to be from the earliest ages on. And truthfully, this can be, I believe that Rav Cohen spoke about this last night, so I don't want to duplicate it, but this can be inserted in almost any limud, certainly in Chumash, And even in Mishnayos and Gemara, when we learn about a machlokes, we can begin to discuss with them, give them a little bit of Rosh Hashanah, that there's a system at work here, and that there was a Messiah, except that a certain point got lost in the Messiah. That's where you got the machlokes from. But they have to feel a certain confidence in the Amunah. That's when they're younger. When they're older, they need to hear a proper substantiation of our Amunah. Now, if it's not brought about through their asking questions, perhaps we don't have to ask the questions directly, but we certainly have to tell them the answers in such a way that they will realize that if someone asks, how do I know that there's a Bere Olam, that's the answer. How do I know that Teres Min HaShemayim? I know the answer. And so that is what we want to speak about tonight. We want to speak about three subjects tonight, if we have the time, Be'ezras Hashem. Teres Min HaShemayim, which means the revelation at Har Sinai, that it actually took place. It's a historical fact. It's not a whim. It's not a fairy tale. It's the absolute truth. It's a historical fact. And we want to substantiate that. Then Be'ezras Hashem will speak about other evidence of Teirah Min HaShemayim based on various psukim in the Torah. And at the end, if we have time, Be'ezras Hashem will speak about the evidence of the existence of the Bere Olam. Now, it's very important that we should know as follows. In our Emunah, it is my humble opinion that no leap of faith is ever required. We don't need somebody to get some kind of emotional high to all of a sudden feel inspired and say, I believe. Some magical or mystical osmosis where he just believes. We believe that the entire Emunah is based on Seichel HaYoshar, on simple common sense, to the point where after we substantiate the Emunah, we turn around and we say to the Talmidim, it's difficult to understand how somebody who has any sense would not be a Maimon. It's difficult to understand. Because Emunah is based on intellectual common sense. It's rational and it requires no leap of faith. Now, of course, if you make a statement like that, then the presentation must be compelling. They have to walk away saying, you know, you're right. There has to be a Bere Olam. Terah has to be Min HaShemayim. Of course there was a Hizgalus Bahar Sinai, based on the Masorah, as we will speak. Periodically, to review the subject and to add on some additional points that will strengthen the position so that they keep reviewing it. Now, if these Yesodos, if these fundamental principles are established, are strong by the Talmidim, like pillars of iron, if it's clear to a Talmud or to a Talmida that there is a Bere Olam, it's not, you know, I believe this, you believe that. Some people do believe, some people don't. No, there is a Bere Olam. It's evident. If that's clear. If it's clear to a Talmud and a Talmida that this Bere Olam communicated with the Jewish people and gave us a Torah. A Torah Shebiksav and a Torah Shebaalpeh. Now, I didn't put in my notes anything about the Torah Shebaalpeh tonight because I'm sure we won't get to it. But that's very, very fundamental, however. But if it becomes clear through the course of the discussions that there is Min HaShamayim given to us by the Bere Olam, a Torah Shebiksav v'Shebaalpeh, a written and an oral Torah, the Sefer Torah, is a letter from the Ribbono Shel Olam. Except that letter can only be understood with the Pirush of the Torah Shebaal Peh. And that was also from the Ribbono Shel Olam from the very first days. After those principles are clear to the Talmid, from then on, thank you so much, from then on, it's smooth sailing. Because all other questions can be answered in light of the principles that they have already absorbed. I don't know if you people can guess how long ago I learned geometry in 10th grade. But when we learned geometry in 10th grade, I don't know how they teach it today, but there was one theorem. The first theorem was that the shortest distance between two points is a straight line. They proved it from logic, and then they used that to prove other things. Once the axioms are clear, you never go back. You never go back because that's clear. Then you can use the axioms to prove other things. So if Teres Min HaShemayim and the Borei Olam communicated with us, so then all we have to do is to look into his Torah and see how the Ribbono Shel Olam runs the world. We can see Schar V'Oinesh, reward and punishment. We see Hashgacha. We see divine providence. Because after all, you say to the Talmud, Du Gleibst the Halein, you yourself agree that this Torah is a letter from HaShemayim. This is a letter to you from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It's got your name on the envelope. It's written to you. And this is HaKadosh Baruch Hu's information that he gave over to the Klal Yisrael. And therefore, in this Tirush HaBiksav and Tirush HaBaal Peh, we can see an answer to almost every question that comes up, including contemporary issues. Because, you know, our Torah HaShlema, our Torah is so perfect and complete, there's no subject that isn't touched on someplace. Maybe not in exactly the same terms that we speak in contemporary language, but the concepts are there. And all we need do is apply them to everyday life. And so therefore, we can turn to a Talmud and say, now that you already agree and understand that the Torah is from the Ribbono Shel Olam, let's look in our Svarim, which stem from that Chochmah of the Chochmas HaBorei, and we'll see what the Ribbono Shel Olam has to say about this subject. And then, if it sits right with you, is avada good. It's good. But if you have difficulty with it, you have to understand, this is what the Ribbono Shel Olam says. You have some difficulty with this particular issue? Well, it could be that if you had lived 100 years ago, you would have had no difficulty, because people thought differently then. So maybe you've been influenced by the times, by the media. Maybe you just haven't delved enough into the subject. But you yourself understand that this is the wisdom of the Ribbono Shel Olam. When a Talmud says, so why should I keep a chok? I don't know the reason for it. You say to him, but you know that it comes from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And when you go to the doctor and he gives you a prescription, you go to the pharmacy and you look on the shelves in the pharmacy and you see that there are 1,000 different pills, maybe more, on the shelf. The doctor said, not the yellow ones, not the yellow ones, not the pink ones. No, you get the little white ones. Only that one. There are many little white ones, but you need only one certain one. That's the one you've got to have. Do you know why? Do you know why that pill over another pill? If you don't know more about medicine than I do, then the answer is no, you don't know why. But you know that the doctor knows medicine and you trust him. So we have a Borei Olam who gave us information. The Borei Olam said, Chazir is not good for you. Shatness is not good for you. And I'm not telling you why. Because maybe the reason is because you won't understand it. Or maybe the reason is because I want you to trust me. It's an exercise in trust. But once the Talmud agrees that Kol HaTorah Kula is coming from the Ribbono Shel Olam, then there's no more difficulty in observing a chok than there is in observing a mishpat, than observing a halacha as logical as kibud av va'em or not stealing. So the Rabbonans is part of the discussion of the Tirush HaBaal Peh, but the Rabbonans were sanctioned by the Torah, like just like every country has its lawmakers that enact laws, and under new circumstances they make new rules and regulations. So the Torah gave the power to the Sanhedrin to enact laws for the protection and preservation of the Torah. And these are sanctioned by the Ushmarta Mishmarti, Asu Mishmeres L'Mishmarti. We learn it from a pasuk, and we have it in the Torah Shebaal Peh, that this is the right that the Rachamim were given. Therefore, if they were given this, so then this is part of Torah. You can make Birkas HaTorah on learning it in the Rabbanan. Huh?
They messed it up.
Who messed it up?
The Rabbanon.
The Rabbanon?
Right.
Okay, so for this Rav Osher, you're going to have to listen to the Torah Shebaal Peh. It takes me 9 hours to do this. That's why I'm trying to fit in a few subjects tonight. V'kitzur nimrots. For that they have to know, and we have to train them throughout the years, who the Rabbanon were. Who were the Moisrei HaTorah? What kind of an awesome Messiah we have. Who were, not only was it that we heard it from our parents and from our grandparents, mother to daughter, father to son, Rebbe to Talmud, but who were the Roshei HaMessiah, the heads of this transmission of Torah, the G'doyle Olam? We had hundreds of thousands of Geonim, maybe more than that, B'meshech, in the course of the last 3,000 years. And what their character was like, and what their midas were like, and how devoted and dedicated they were to giving over the Torah. And after that, right, and if we bring Mishalim from people who lived closer to our time, that we can see their godless, so then they begin to understand that we're not to be chayshed the Chachamim, that they distorted or perverted anything from the Torah Shebaal Peh, but they merely gave over what they had received. So we're going to go now to the Hisgalus by Har Sinai. The revelation at Har Sinai. Now, this is a presentation that really takes 2 hours. And I cannot give over the entire presentation, because we want to fit in, we don't have 2 hours anymore, and there are other subjects I want to cover. I will tell you that I brought CDs here. They are available. There's a summary of them on page 3, a Haskama on page 4 of your booklet, and an order form on page 5. I don't think I'll run out of them, so you won't need the order form if you want to buy them tonight. If you want to order them, you can order them. I'll send them to you by mail. But I'm going to try my best to squeeze in as much of this presentation as I can, because it's very, very fundamental. So the Klal Yisrael have a claim. What is our claim? What is our claim? Our claim is, now, a claim, anybody can make a claim, right? I can say I'm a Mashiach too. I don't think anybody's going to believe me, but I can make the claim. It's a free country. But let's first analyze our claim. You have to know that even before we get to substantiating the claim, our claim is different than anyone else's claim. We claim that we had a public revelation from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That HaKadosh Baruch Hu, after performing all the Eisos, the Maifsin, the Makos, the Mitzrayim, and the Kriyas Yamsuf, and after the Mon had started falling, and they had the Be'er, and all the other Amud Eish and the Amud Onon, after all of this, we were gathered in front of Har Sinai, and the Ribbono Shel Olam spoke to us in a public revelation. He told us the Aseres HaDibrois, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu appointed Moshe Rabbeinu to be his Navi. This is our claim. And that from that time on, the Jewish people gave over this historical phenomena to the next generation. And this is what they said. They said, Kindalach, I was there. Mommy was there. Uncle Chaim was there. And the entire generation was there. We all saw it. You can ask anyone from our generation. You weren't born yet, but we all stood by Har Sinai when HaKadosh Baruch Hu spoke to us. I mean, the mountain trembled and the fire and the smoke, but HaKadosh Baruch Hu spoke to us. And we heard him. We had this awesome experience. Not one person, not 100 people, but 600,000 men between 20 and 60, an equal number of women, children under 20, Zkenim and Zkenis, and we all stood there and heard this. And generation number two gave over to their children, and they said, Kindalach, I wasn't there. But Bubby and Zadie told us, and everyone in their generation told their children that they were there and it happened. And generation number three gave it over to generation number four, down till our time. And this was given over worldwide wherever Jews live. No matter how far back you go in Jewish history, you will discover that this was the Amunah of Roiv of Klal Yisrael. We'll soon talk about those who didn't believe. But this was the Amunah of the Roiv of Klal Yisrael that they gave it over. And I say this often in the Kirav Shir, that even those who didn't receive this from their parents, if they will investigate a little bit, they will undoubtedly discover that not so long ago, their ancestors were also part of this chain, but at a certain point in time, their children broke away at the time of the Reform. That's a whole subject in itself, CD number 7, but that's a whole subject in itself. What happened? But what happened then has no bearing or reflection on any chisaron in the Masorah, because that wasn't their issue. They had other issues. They had ulterior motives, and they just wanted out. They said, even if it's true, I'm not interested. So, and this is what it says in the Chumash throughout. Throughout the Chumash, the Torah tells us that everything that happened was la'enei kol ha'am, was the last three words in the Torah, Asher Osa Moshe, La'enei Kol Yisrael, everything Moshe did was done. This is our claim. I haven't substantiated it yet. But it was done in front of the eyes of all the people. Nothing happened in private. We don't ask anybody to believe based on things that happened. Now, yeah, certainly once you know the Torah is Min HaShemayim, then you can believe even if the Torah tells you that something happened in private. But the substantiation of our Amunah is not based on things that took place in private. It's based on things that took place only publicly. The Eser Makos, the Kriyas Yamsuf, the Mon, the Be'er, the swallowing of Kairach, and of course, Maimad Har Sinai, the Amud Esh, the Amud Onon, all of these things took place publicly. And this is what the Sefer HaChinuch says in his introduction. He says, the Ribbono Shel Olam, everyone knows that we should rely on testimony of witnesses, and the more the witnesses are, the stronger is the testimony. And therefore, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the Hashgacha, arranged that the Torah should be given in front of such a large number of people, a few million people, so that the Me'idim, those that testify on the truth of the Hisgalus, should be many, many, and they should continue to give it over to their generations. And the Rambam says in Hilchos Yesodei HaTorah, he says, Klal Yisrael did not believe in Moshe Rabbeinu because of the miracles that he wrought. If you believe because of miracles, so maybe somebody will come along and do a bigger miracle. Maybe it's kishuf, maybe it's magic. They believed in him, v'mehaminu bo'i. Because of what did they believe him? Because we heard HaKadosh Baruch Hu speak to us and to him. and say, Moshe, Moshe, Leichem Erlohem. Moshe, go and tell them, kach vekach, such and such. So we heard Moshe Rabbeinu, and therefore we don't need anybody to testify to us about Moshe Rabbeinu. You know, if somebody says, how do you know that couple is married? I danced at the chasana. I know. We were there when Moshe Rabbeinu became HaKadosh Baruch Hu's Navi. And so the Ramban says in Seif Parshas Boy, a very famous Ramban, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu commanded us to remember always the miracles of Mitzrayim, because since they're not going to be repeated for every scoffer who comes along and says, hey, if you're up there, prove it. Rabbi Shlomo says, I don't have to, I proved it once. And the Klal Yisrael testifies to it by giving it over in an unbroken chain of Masorah. And therefore, he says, when you put a mezuzah on your door, when you put a mezuzah on your doorway, and which declares the yichud of the Bnei Yisborach and the Nisim of Mitzrayim, you are testifying to your emuna in all the fundamentals of Torah. And that is the Masorah that Klal Yisrael have. Now, we have a principle. So that's our claim. Haraitza l'shaker, yarchi kedusai. If someone wants to lie, he talks about far-off matters. If I want to lie to you about something, so I don't tell you a lie that you can easily investigate, because you'll catch me. You'll prove me a liar. If I want to tell you, if I want to sell you something, so I tell you that I just came from a faraway land and there I did this and I did that and I have so many investments, it's not so easy. So then, if the person is lying, you won't be able to disprove him. On what will you base your acceptance or your rejection of his presentation, of his proposition, whether you're impressed with him? If he sounds sincere, if he seems to be intelligent, if he's an orator, these are the things that win over the masses. And since they can't check out the claims, so they base their acceptance on their impression of the speaker. So haraitza l'shaker, Chazal say, if somebody wants to lie, yarchi kedusa, he speaks of far off matters. The Kuzari tells us a fundamental principle in Emunah. He says, you cannot convince people that they had experiences that they never had. I can tell you that I had experiences, and you don't know whether I did or I didn't. And they can even be far-fetched. And if you have trust in me, if I make a good impression on you, maybe you'll believe me. We have major world religions that are based on the word of just somebody said he had a revelation. But I cannot tell you, I can't even tell you that you had a flat tire on the way to the class tonight if you didn't. I can't tell it to you because you know you didn't. So you cannot convince a person that they had experiences that they never had. And this is the emunah of the Klal Yisrael. We say that we are the descendants. We have an unbroken chain of testimony that goes back to the first day that the people accepted the Torah. Why did they accept the Torah? Because they knew that they had these experiences. If they didn't have these experiences, they never could have accepted it. It's impossible. Now, if you leave this wonderful shul here and you'll find your nearest Reformed temple, and you'll go in there and you'll ask them, so how did the Torah get started? The rabbi will surely tell you. Say, listen, Moses was a very smart man. Something along these lines. Moses was a smart man. He saw that the people needed a discipline. So he told them, I'm going up to the mountain to get a Torah. Hey, he snuck around the back of the mountain and drank a couple of beers. And anyway, he came back and he brought them the Torah and they believed him. And that's how it got started. And that's how it got started. Before I go any further, I want to give you a little example. Imagine that tomorrow I go downtown here in New York, Manhattan, the busiest street corner in Manhattan, and I have a little platform that I stand on with a megaphone, and I say, hear ye, hear ye. I had a revelation. Will I get a crowd? You bet. People have nothing to do at lunchtime. There are lots of curiosity seekers. And they'll come and listen for curiosity. But I am a very inspiring speaker. And I speak with tremendous emotion. I wave my hands and I say, last night, when I lie on my bed in my third story window, I saw a face peering in at me. I'd never seen anything so glorious and shining before in my life. And the face said to me, I am the creator of the universe. And you, George Schwarzenstein, you will be my prophet. You'll create a group called the Redeemers of the Universe. You'll solve all the world's problems. Now go out and get people to join under your banner. Could there be some people who will be taken in? Yes. If Reverend Moon can do it, so can I. If the guy who started the Mormons can do it, so can I. But if I were to tell them, last night, you were lying on your bed, you saw the face spoke to you, there isn't one, even the simplest, least intelligent among that crowd, would not accept my words and will walk away from me and consider me a raving lunatic because they know it didn't happen to them. And therefore, if we play devil's advocate, so let's say, okay, Torah's not true, chas v'shalom, all the miracles didn't happen. So what happened when Moshe Rabbeinu brought down the Sefer Torah? When he brought down this Torah? So he brought a Torah. He said, okay, these are the mitzvahs, do them. Okay, they said, okay, we'll do them. We're ready to go. Shabbos, Taras HaMishpachat, Stok HaMaiser. No, they said, Moshe, would you mind if we look before we start keeping? Could we look? Or could we take a? He can't say no. He says, okay, here it is. They say, Moshe, you know, it says in your Sefer that you're giving us, that you're telling us God gave you, that we all crossed the Red Sea together, and the water stood up in two walls. Now, you know that's not true, Moshe. You know it was low tide, and we took off our socks, and we waded across. We got our toesies wet. And you say here that for 40 years, bread fell from the sky? For 40 years, day after, and only 6 days a week, not on Shabbos. And on Shabbos, Friday, we got a double portion. You know that's not true. You know we went out every morning with our baskets. We try to find some wild berries, and we drank cactus water. We didn't have a moving stone that gave water. You know it's not true. You know when we went to Mount Sinai there and you disappeared for a while, you know the mountain wasn't trembling. You know we didn't hear Hashem speak through a loud. There was no loudspeaker then. We didn't hear a loudspeaker. You know this all didn't happen. You know we didn't see Korach get swallowed up and his men amongst everybody else and only they got swallowed up. You know it never happened. So you're nothing but a liar. You're a blatant liar. And you expect us based on this foolishness to keep this Torah? And nevertheless, the Jewish people did accept the Torah. And they did begin keeping it. And not only that, you know, throughout the Tanakh covers a period from the Avos, from Bereshis, the Avos, down to Yetzias Mitzrayim, and then down till the end of Golus Bavel. From the time the Torah was given, about 1,000 years. In the entire Tanakh period, there were lots of sinners. There were plenty of people who did this sin or that, and the Nevi'im came and they blasted them. They let them have it, you know, in certain terms. Never once does the Tanakh speak about anyone who said, I don't believe in the miracles that took place by Mitzrayim or in Matan Torah. It doesn't exist there. It's not there. Because even the Avdei Avodah Zarah believed. They worshipped idols. Lahavdil, the Christians and the Muslims also believe in the revelation at Sinai. They just have their other Torah, which maybe we'll have a chance to speak a little bit about. So we would, when I present this, I say to the people that anybody, if anybody could offer me some sensible scenario how this Mesorah could have possibly gotten started. So someone will say, well, wait a minute. You're assuming that the Torah was given in the days of this supposed Moshe Rabbeinu. Maybe he never lived. Maybe it happened like this. It was Chaim Yoina. Chaim Yoina came along and he told the people, you know what? God revealed himself to me and gave me a Torah, which you once had and you forgot or you didn't want to keep. Or I found it in my tent. And so the people would have said, okay, let us take a look at it. Let's see. You know, we're not, you're telling us we should keep Shabbos. We have to have some kind of basis to do this, to keep all these mitzvahs. So they look. They say, you mean to say that we ate man for 40 years and nobody else knows about it but you? Our ancestors never told us? We had a revelation at Sinai and nobody ever heard about it but us, but you? They wouldn't have accepted this. You know, there's a little joke that says that why did HaKadosh Baruch Hu make non-Jews? Because somebody has to buy retail. Right? Jews buy wholesale. You can't sell them something so easily. What, you think that somebody's going to come along with the Torah, with Taryag Mitzvahs, and say, you know what, Hashem told me, okay, no problem. Okay, I'm closing my department store on Shabbos. We're keeping Taras HaMishpacha. I'm giving a tenth of my money to Tzedakah, or a tenth of my produce to Meiser, and I'm bringing Kabbonis. I'm coming up to Yerushalayim. I'm schlepping up to Yerushalayim 3 times. I'm not going to accept that without some kind of a basis. It's lunacy to think that that's the way it happened. And if you'll say, well, this Chaim Yoinu didn't give up so easily. He called out the militia, or he debated with them for tens of years. So we say, isn't it strange that it only filtered down to us that we got the Torah by Har Sinai and we never lost it? We have no record, no recollection, not written or oral. There's no recollection of a period in time when this Torah was new and not heard of before. There's no such recollection. Because if there were, if it were true what this scoffer is proposing, then this should be Jewish history. Jewish history is to say like this. Moshe Rabbeinu accepted the Torah by Har Sinai, but the people were bad and they neglected it for 500 years. Or they forgot it because of various circumstances. Along came Chaim Yoina, and Chaim Yoina revived the Torah, and even though the people were skeptical at first, he argued with them, he debated with them, he called out the militia, and he forced them, and they finally accepted it. That should be Jewish history. And if there's no recollection of such a thing, it's only because it never happened, because we had the Torah from the first day, from the time that we say it was given. And you know, there's a difference between a historical version or a person who's just fantasizing with chalaimus and reinterpreting history retroactively. Let me give you an example. If somebody were to say, you know, there never was a George Washington. He never really lived. What happened was the colonies were losing the war very badly. They needed a figurehead. They needed somebody to inject some encouragement into the colonies' armies. So somebody invented a George Washington. They said, okay, we're over here in New York, but down in Virginia, George Washington is winning battle after battle, so let's go, we're going to... And after a while, the stories grew and grew, and that's how you get George Washington. Okay? Would anybody take such a version seriously? Now, could I disprove it? I never met George. I never spoke to him. But we know from history, the historical version is that George Washington was the general who led them to victory in the Revolutionary War and became the first president of the United States. If he chopped down the cherry tree or not, this I don't know. That's not history. That's folklore. But maybe he did, I don't know. But that there was a George Washington who was the first president of the United States, that's history. Any other version is mere speculation because the person says, I would prefer to explain it otherwise. And that's what it was. All the dissenting groups that ever came along among the Jewish people and said, we don't believe, we don't accept, like the Tzedakim in the second Beis HaMikdash and the Karoyim in Bovel, the Karaites. They came along after the established Messiah and they came and said, you know what, we don't accept it. Based on what? Did they have a counter Messiah? Did they have some evidence that the Messiah was wrong? They said, no, we don't like it. You know why we don't accept it? Because we don't like it. Because if we accept it, then we have to follow it. And we don't want to follow it. So we don't accept it. We say it's not true. Then we say it's not true. But they always came along against the established historical Masara of the Jewish people and said, no, we're not Makaba, we don't accept it. I want to tell you a story. Supposedly it happened in the time a few hundred years ago in Europe. I don't know if the story is true or not, but the moral of the story is very true. So the Karoyim, the Karaites, claimed that they didn't believe in the Torah Shebaal Peh. They said you only get what's written in the literal word of the Torah, and we don't believe that the rabbis have any right to enact any laws. And they were very, very powerful. They actually threatened to swallow up the Jewish people about over 1,000 years ago. And Rabbi Nasad Yagoin stood in the breach and he disputed with them and he turned the tide. But there were still strong pockets of Karoyim even in Europe. And in one particular place, the Karoyim got the ear of the king. And they said to him, you know, why should we have two Jewish communities? Let's arrange a debate between the Karoyim and the rabbinic Jews, the Jews who believe in the Rabbonon, the traditional Jews, and whichever group will win will be the victor, will be the recognized community. The king said, that's a very good idea. Now the Karoyim had a leader who was an expert in the art of debate, and they were confident that they would win. Whereas the Rav, in that place, although he was a big Talmud Chacham, was not experienced in debating, and he was indeed very nervous about this debate. When the day of the debate came, he made a very grave error. You see, in that time, the rule of etiquette in the palace was that everyone who entered the throne room had to leave his shoes outside. And the Rav was so nervous that he forgot, and he came in with his shoes on. And when he looked around and he saw everyone else in stocking feet, so what could he do? He couldn't go back out, so he slipped out of his shoes and he stood next to them. When the Karaite got up to begin the debate, he said, Your Majesty, before I even begin, I want to point out the audacity of my opponent. that he didn't have the respect for your majesty to follow the most basic rule of etiquette in the palace, which is to leave his shoes outside. Now the king hadn't noticed, but now he looked, and he sees that the Rav is standing next to his shoes, and the king is livid with rage. What is the meaning of this? And the Rav says, Your Majesty, if you bear with me for one moment, I think I can explain everything. He said, You know, Your Majesty, the first time that God appeared to Moses on Mount Sinai was by the burning bush. And he said to Moshe, Shal ne'alecha me'al raglecha, take your shoes off your feet because the place upon which you stand is holy. Why couldn't Hashem send an angel to Moshe Rabbeinu before he went up to the mountain and tell him to leave his shoes down at the bottom of the mountain? Ah, the answer is, Your Majesty, because the mountain was surrounded by Karaites. And Karaites are notorious for stealing shoes. And Hashem didn't want Moshe Rabbeinu's shoes to get stolen. So he let him bring his shoes up with him to Har Sinai and take them off on the mountain. And so I too, Your Majesty, was afraid that my shoes would be stolen because the anteroom is filled with Karaites who are notorious for stealing. So I brought in my shoes to the throne room and I took them off inside. So the Karaite got up and he said, That's a lie, it's a lie. There were no Karaites by Mount Sinai. Our religion only started 700 years ago. The king said, What? They started 3,000 years ago, and you came along 700 years ago, and you're going to tell them how to interpret the Torah? This debate is over. It simply makes no sense. We have a Masoreh from the first day. Wherever you go in history, the zealots who held up in Masada, there are 7 mikvois there. They were flumi yidden. They weren't obeying the instructions of the Chachamim, but they were flumi yidden. They also were ma'amin and b'tayre. That's already you've clipped off 2,000 years from the difficulty of believing this 3,300-year-old Messiah. Wherever you go in history, the Tanakh certainly. So we turn to all the dissenting groups. We say, you come along 3,000 years later and you're going to tell us what really happened by Har Sinai. We know what happened by Har Sinai. We gave it over to our children at every Pesach Seder for the last 3,320 years. And so now you see the difference, lahavdil, between our faith, our claim, and all the others. Because no one else even could claim such a thing. You know, the communists would have loved to say to their prisoners in Soviet Russia that no one ever believed in God. It's a silly, because they told them it's a silly thing to do. They would have loved to say that no one ever believed in God. So you shouldn't either. But they couldn't say that. Because everybody knew that the generation that came before the communists, they were religious, whether they were Jews or whether they were Christians, lahavdil, they couldn't get away with a lie like that. They couldn't get away with a lie like that. And neither can anybody else. And that's why nobody else could ever say that they had a public revelation, because everybody would have known that it's a lie. And the only one on the face of the globe that claims that they ever had a public revelation is the Klal Yisrael. And therefore we say, when Yashka came along, when Paul spread the belief in Christianity, Yashka was long gone from the scene. By the way, there's nothing written from contemporary times about Yashka. The church themselves don't know exactly when he lived. They don't know exactly when he lived. The only thing that's written about Yashka from the period before the disciples came along is what it says in our Gemara. That's the only thing that's written about contemporary times. There's nothing else. And so when they told the people, Yashka did this and Yashka did that, the people had no way of knowing whether Yashka... They said Yashka amassed crowds and they believed in it, but they had no way of knowing whether he did that or not. or whether he walked on water or did miracles or did not. The disciples told them, and because they were convincing, many believed them. And Muhammad? Muhammad had a revelation. Who was with him to witness it? His donkey. That's not what we say about them. That's what they say about themselves. His donkey was there to witness it. And when Muhammad came down, he said, I had a revelation from Allah. They said, Muhammad, do us a favor. Go jump in the lake. He pulled out a sword. He said, I had a revelation from Allah. Do you believe me? They said, emphatically. We sure do. He said, will you go conquer nations for the greater glory of Allah? They said, we're on our way. And they went and they conquered nation after nation, who changed over from the worship of the Baal to the worship of Allah in their cheder. So what does that prove? What kind of a substantiation is that? But we say that our Torah is based on a public revelation. And you can't tell people that they had experiences that they never had. That is the essence of the presentation of the revelation at Sinai. And now we're going to go on to the next subject. Torah min hashamayim, based on marvels from the psukim. The Torah gave us two parshiyos about the destiny of the Jewish people, if they will observe the Torah or if they will chas v'shalom deviate from the path of the Torah. These two parshiyos are called the Techacha. One is in B'chukosai and one is in Kisavai. And there's a very long Ramban in Parshas B'chukosai. It's a mitzvah for everybody to know this Ramban. There are people who know the Ramban and never stop to realize that this is a fabulous demonstration of Torah min hashamayim. And unfortunately, I can't go through this Ramban with you tonight because it takes me an hour and a half to do. But the Ramban says as follows, that the details in B'chukosai are not the same details that are mentioned in Kisavai. The Torah says, if you stray from the Torah, A, B, C, D, E, F, G will happen to you. And in Kisavai it says, if you stray from the Torah, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, O, P. Different things. Sastira. The Ramban says, no. If you look into history, you look into Tanakh, and even if you look in Josephus, who was a historian who lived at the time of the second Beis HaMikdash, at the Churban Bayis Sheni, he's not one of ours. He's a renegade, but he wrote a history. You'll see that the details in B'chukosai match exactly what happened by the first Beis HaMikdash, Churban Bayis Rishon, and the details that are foretold in Parshas Kisavai match exactly what actually took place by the Churban Bayis Sheni by the Romans. Now, I don't even want to mention them here in this Makom Kodesh, the Bible critics who post-date the writing of the Torah. They also have to agree that the Torah was written at least a few hundred years before Churban Bayis Sheni, the whole Torah. Because at that time, you all know the story of Talmai HaMelech, who invited 70s, they were in control of Eretz Yisrael, the king of Mitzrayim was in control of Eretz Yisrael. He told the Kohen Gadol to send him 70 Chachamim. He put them in separate houses, and they translated the Torah for him into Greek, and that's called the Septuagint. I don't speak Greek. It's all Greek to me. And since that time, the Goyim have been in possession of what they call the Bible. And so the Parsha in Kisavai is even a proof against the Bible critics, who would postdate the writing of the Torah, because it describes accurately the destruction, the takeover of the Romans of Eretz Yisrael. And I'll just give you a couple of examples so you'll see what we're talking about. In the Techacha, in B'chukosai, it says, Hashem will bring on you a nation. Hashem will send on you a nation, and you'll go into Golis. I'll scatter you amongst the nations. I'll scatter you amongst the nations. In Kisavo, it says, I will scatter you from one end of the earth to the other end of the earth. Doesn't say that in B'chukai Zayin. Because by the Chum Bayis Rishon, we were scattered in the Middle East. Some people went to Persia, some people went to Babel, they ran away to Mitzrayim. But after the Chum Bayis Sheni, we became dispersed all over the globe. And we're still in Golus Edom. We're still in the Golus that Rome perpetrated on us. In the B'chukai Zayin, it doesn't say anything about the separation of families. It says you're going to go into Golus. In Kisavo, it says that the parents are going to look longingly, their sons and daughters will be taken away from them, and they'll look longingly for them, and they're not returning. Because Rome had a very vigorous slave market, and they took the youth and sent them to other parts of the world to be sold for slaves. So there, by Golus Bavel, families went together. Whoever remained alive went together in families, in family groups. There was no separation of families. Whereas, by the Golus of Rome, the children were taken away from them. And so the Ramban goes through detail by detail, and he shows you how the Churban Bayis Rishon was accurately described in Parshas B'chukai Zayin, and Churban Bayis Sheni was accurately described in Kisavo. It's an astounding demonstration of the Ribbono Shel Olam being in total control of his world and telling us in advance exactly what is going to happen. But I'm going to deal in the next few minutes with only four psukim from the very end of the Techacha in Kisavo. These psukim, after we take a good look at them under a magnifying glass and we bring out what they are saying, are nothing short of astounding. And when I make this presentation, I say to people, you know, people ask a lot of kashas on us. They have kashas. Okay. But we have kashas too. We say, how is it possible for anyone not to believe that the Ribbono Shel Olam gave us the Torah? And I read these psukim, and this is what the psukim say. I don't know if there's a chumash here. Be of help.
Well, we get one.
It would be of help.
We'll get a couple.
Just one. I think one will do. Thank you very much. Does he know you brought one?
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks. Thank you very much. So the pasuk says as follows. After the description of all the terrible things that will befall the Jewish people, the pasuk says as follows. You will hear now 2,000 years of destiny in Golus. We'll just do four psukim. For those of you who'd like to look inside, it's on page 1082. If you have a chumash, but I will read them to you. It's on page 1082, and we're going to start from Pasuk Samach Beis. So the Torah says, okay, you're going to go into exile. V'nish'artem b'mesei me'ot. You will remain small in number. Tachas asher heyisem kechoich mehashamayim lehoi. Instead of what you were, like the stars of the heaven for many. So the Torah foretells here that the Jewish people are going to remain small in number. Pasuk Samach Gimel. V'haya, and it will come to be. Kasher sos Hashem aleichem, as Hashem rejoiced over you. Lehavid eschem, ulahashmid eschem. As Hashem, I skipped a line. As Hashem rejoiced over you, to do good to you and to increase you. Kein yosis Hashem aleichem. So will Hashem make others rejoice. If anybody translates this rejoice, Hashem never rejoices to harm the Jewish people, but he will make others rejoice over you. Lehavid eschem al hashmid eschem, to destroy you and to wipe you out. You'll be plucked up from the land where you come to inherit it into Galus. And these will be the circumstances of Galus. You'll remain small in number, and they will rejoice to destroy you. So the Torah foretold us the phenomena of anti-Semitism. The Goyim will take pleasure in hating us. They will enjoy it. Verse Samach Dalet. Vehefitzcha Hashem bechol ha'amim. Hashem will scatter you amongst all the nations. Mikitzei ha'oretz v'yad kitzei ha'oretz. From the end of the earth until the end of the earth. Let's stop here. The Torah tells us here that the Jewish people will be dispersed all over the globe. If you hurry, maybe you can still catch the last Maariv in Tokyo, or Buenos Aires, or Johannesburg, or Fairbanks, Alaska, or Dallas, Texas, or Mexico City, or Vienna, or Antwerp, or London, or Paris. We are all over the globe. You'll worship their other gods. Shelo yodata, that you never knew before. Atava visecha. Eitzva oven, wood and stone. In some of the various programs that they run, the Discovery, the Arachim, I think they point out that the two major world religions, Lahavdil, Elaf Alfe, Elaf Mavdalis, that compete with us. So the sign of Christianity is the wooden cross, and the sign of Islam is the stone at Mecca. So eitz va'oven. But be that as it may, so the Torah tells us, in Galus you will not remain faithful. It doesn't mean everyone, but there will be those who will go to Avodah Zarah. Samachay. Uvagayim ahem loisargia. Among those nations you shall not rest. And there won't be a resting place for the sole of your foot. Let's stop here. The Torah foretells us about the persecutions and the discriminations amongst those nations. You will not rest. You're not going to have a picnic when you go into the other nations. Going to be trouble. Thanks. You're going to have trouble there. And there won't be a resting place for the sole of your foot means there'll be no permanence. You might be in a country for many years. But then they say, move on. Like Avimelech said to Yitzchak in last week's parsha, Lech me'emanu, ki atzamtu mimenu. You take away all our wealth. How many times have we heard that in history? The Jews are parasites. They compete with us. They take away all our wealth. Everyone, we'll get back to that. So there we have predicted in the first half of Samach, hey, all the persecutions and discriminations, the head taxes, and the restrictions that were put on the Jewish people for the 2,000 years, in the words of Agoyim Ahem Loi Sargia, and all the banishments and the exiles. There isn't a country in Europe that didn't banish their Jews at some time. In England, it was forbidden on pain of death for a Jew to be present in England for 300 years. Until Menashe ben Yisrael convinced them that they should let Jews come back in. There's a There was a Rav named Rav Shimon First, who came from Vienna. He wrote a sefer about Derech HaLimud. But in the beginning of the sefer, Zechanu Levracha, he wrote about his city, Vienna. And he describes the history of Vienna. It was like high tide and low tide. Along came a certain king. He let them build a shul. Then the next king came along. He tore down the shul. He sent them out. This guy brought them back. This in and out. This is the history of Jews in Europe. In Russia, Jews were not allowed past a certain border. They were not allowed east of a certain border. It was called the Pale of Settlement. Jews were not allowed. And one time the Tsar got in his head that all Jews have to move to the big cities in the 1800s. So most Jews lived in Derfalach, in little villages, and all Jews had to leave their homes and crowd together and compete with each other in the big cities. And then it says, V'nosan Hashem l'choshom leiv ragoz. Hashem will give you there a trembling heart. And longing of eyes means despair. V'davoy nofesh, and anguish. Here we see a very, very fascinating thing. You know, Jews throughout their exile did very little historically to defend themselves from their persecutors. There were some exceptions. There was the Warsaw Ghetto. But generally, now, we don't look disparagingly on them for this. First of all, they were basically defenseless. What could a handful of Jews do without weapons against the establishment and against the masses? But we know that there was a personality, a meekness, scaredy cat mentality amongst the Jews, where they sort of went like sheep to the slaughter. And we also know that it wasn't that way before. I'm going to come back to that in just a second. So we see here from these psukim an outline of 2,000 years of Golus. And the strange thing is that not a single one of these things is a logical thing. Because you all know that Jews, except for maybe the fact that they have larger noses than some people, Jews bring a blessing of prosperity wherever they go. The Jews lived in Poland for 1,000 years. They were invited to come to Poland by the rulers, because the rulers knew that they would bring prosperity. Jews are merchants, they do business, they're financiers, and they did. And in the end, between the First World War and the Second World War, the Poles boycotted the Jewish stores and they said, "Jews, go home, because you're taking away everything that we have." It's not a logical thing. In America, there shouldn't be any anti-Semitism, because Jews are doing exactly what the Gentiles admire. They are successful in the professions. They are scientists. They are doctors. If we would be Irish, they would look up to us. But because we are Jewish, they hate us. They're jealous of us. So we'll go back. I don't know how many Chinese people there were at the time that these words were written, but there are an awful lot of them now. And if you do the calculations on your calculator, if you say that there were 2 million Jews when the Torah was written, there ought to be about 1 billion of them now. And still, our numbers never increase in Galus above a certain minimal limit. We never get larger. Whatever the circumstances are, whether it's because of intermarriage, whether it's because of pogroms, whether it's because of Holocaust, but whatever it is, the Torah somehow knew that we would never increase too large, too much. It's not a logical thing. It's not something that one would predict. It's not something that one would predict that Jews who are such productive people would be hated no matter where they go, no matter what we do. You know, when the Jews were poor, they were looked down on. When the Jews were not educated in secular studies, they were looked down on. Now the Jews are educated. Many Jews are educated. They're professionals. They're successful. They hate us. When we didn't accept it, when the Goyim were religious and they were fanatics for their faith, so they claimed we killed their God or we rejected their prophet. And now that the Christians, basically it's all commercialized. It's just Christmas stockings, Xmas stockings. And that's basically all it is for most of them. So there's a new kind of anti-Semitism. It's national anti-Semitism. It's racism anti-Semitism. It's new. There's always some new excuse. There's always some reason why they turn against us. But the Torah told us that this is going to be the phenomena of Golos. This is going to happen. And even though books are still being written to explain why they hate us, and we really don't understand it, because we know deep down inside, we don't really hate them. You know, leave us alone and we're fine. No. No. Everything is the Jews' fault. In Poland, they still say that all their troubles are the Jews' fault. They have no Jews. But it's still all the Jews' fault. And there were times when people began to believe that anti-Semitism was over. When the liberalism and the secularism started to take over the world, Germany was at the cutting edge of society. In Germany, they voted equal rights to Jews. Jews were in the professions, Jews were in the government. And we know what happened in the end in Germany. In Russia, after the death of Nikolai I, Yamach Shamay, so Alexander II, I think, took over, and he began letting up all the restrictions on the Jews. And the Jews thought that now the Goyim have finally become enlightened and we're in for good times, we're going to get equal rights, and that was the platform of Haskalah, that they're going to get equal rights. And the same Tsar turned against them with some of the worst discrimination in all of history was perpetrated by the Russian people in the latter half of the 19th century. The Torah said this is the pattern. It's not always and it's not everywhere. There was a golden era in Spain, and then they turned on us with the Spanish Inquisition. And finally we were banished. So one would say, if that's the case, then Jews will simply assimilate. After all, the Torah does say here that you're going to worship other gods. We're not all going to be. So the simplest thing would be to assimilate. No, because in Perek Lamed, the Torah says that Mashiach is going to come. There's going to be a Geula, and there's going to be a Klal Yisrael to come. We're not going to get lost amongst the nations. There's going to be a Klal Yisrael. Now, who would have predicted that the Jewish people would be dispersed from one end of the earth to the other end of the earth? What sense does that make? Who could predict such a thing? Why should anyone predict such a thing? Is there any other nation that has communities all over the world from one end of the globe to the other? It's not a logical thing. Who would pen these words? Why would anyone pen these words? The Jewish people in the second Beis Hamikdash were abirei lev. They were the bravest and the mightiest. In the Bar Kokhba revolution, I don't know if I should say this in front of the ladies, Bar Kokhba, about 50 years after the Churban Bayis, made a revolution against the Romans. And so he, in order to test his soldiers' bravery, he had them, if you don't want to listen, put your fingers on your ears, he had them bite off their thumbs to show that they're not afraid of anything. So the Chachamim sent them a message, you're making Yisrael Bale Mumin. So he said, how should I test them? They said, have them ride on a horse and uproot a cedar tree with their arm while they're riding. And maybe a small cedar tree. So he had 200,000 this way and 200,000 this way. And Josephus tells us about the tremendous bravery. They gave Rome a very hard time, a little country. They gave Rome of the Muhammad for the Churban Beis HaMikdash lasted 9 years and devastated the Roman legions. They finally won. They were tremendously brave. How could the Torah say that you're going to be scaredy cats? And not only that, we know that the people who are in Eretz Yisrael, they're known, lo mefached, they're not afraid of anything, they have tremendous chutzpah, and we've seen many acts of bravery in the various wars that they've had, and Tebis, tremendous bravery. What happened? They went back. These are people who descended from the people from Gaza. The same people. Personalities don't change just because you get your own homeland. The Rebbe Shlom said it's all written here. Hashem will give you v'nos and Hashem l'cho sham lev ragos. There he'll give you a trembling heart. Not you didn't have it before, and when you go back to your homeland, you won't have it again. So it's all foretold 2,000 years of history in 4 psukim. So we turn to the scoffer and we say, maybe you'll tell us who penned these words and how he knew so accurately what was going to befall the Jewish people, even though it made, even now in retrospect, it doesn't make sense. And certainly to predict it in advance makes no sense at all. I want to tell you one more excerpt from the Ramban. In Parshas Bechukai, it says that you're going to go into Golis, but your enemies who live on your land will be desolate. So the Ramban, in the end of his life, the Ramban was forced to debate with 300 priests in Spain. He won the debate. The king gave him a big present. But that Shabbos, the king and the archbishop or some high church came into the shul with the Ramban davened to preach Christianity to the people. And even though the Ramban opposed them, but he saw that it's not safe for him and he has to run away. So he went to Eretz Yisrael and he saw how desolate Eretz Yisrael was. So when he speaks about the desolation that's predicted in the Teichacha, he says, this is a great raya to us of Teirah Min HaShemayim. Because you cannot find a land that was so fertile and is so desolate. If you see the pictures of Eretz Yisrael before the settlers came 100, 150 years ago, it looks like the desert. Bnei Brak was full of sand. When I studied there 44 years ago in Panovich, it was already a city. But wherever there wasn't a house, there was sand. Bnei Brak was built on sand. If you see the pictures of the original settlement of Bnei Brak, when they still had tents there, when they just moved in, it was all sand. There was nothing growing there. And today Eretz Yisrael is luscious and fertile. So the Ramban said, this, the fact that Eretz Yisrael, the Torah told us in advance that the enemies will never have any nachas from Eretz Yisrael. That as long as our enemies rule over Eretz Yisrael, they'll have no nachas from it. Rashi brings this too, that is a great raya to us. But the Ramban only saw the first half. And we are witness to the second half. We are witness that when now that so many Jews live in Eretz Yisrael for the first time in 2,000 years, has begun to yield its peres once again to us. And the Gemara says in Ksubis that is a simen. Ein lecho keitz megulam, he said, you couldn't have a more open simen of the ending of the galus, of the coming of Mashiach, than when Eretz Yisrael will begin to yield its peres. And now I'd like to go on to the very last subject, which is the existence of a Bere Yoylam. Avraham Avinu was the Rosh HaMa'aminim, the first of all believers in HaKadosh Baruch Hu, in a world which knew nothing but idolatry, which had deteriorated from the days of Adam and then from the time of Noach, and had totally forgotten about the Ribbono Shel. They knew nothing but the temples and the statues that they worshipped. And the Rambam describes how Avraham Avinu arrived at the belief in HaKadosh Baruch Hu when he was a little child. He went to worship Avodah Zarah with his parents, Avi V'Imai HaTipshim, fools, and he bowed with them, and as he bowed, he said to himself, no, this is not it. This statue makes the world go around. No. Ki efshe lagalgo lasabe vesatzmoy. A, the planet cannot make itself go around. The world has to have a manhig. Somebody must be guiding this world. And the Rambam says that he came to the recognition of Hashem at age 40. The Gemara says it was at age 3. So the Rabbi Yosef Kara says in Kesef Mishnah, it's no contradiction. He started at 3 and he finished at 40. For 37 years, the Rambam says he was thinking by day and by night until he came to the full emunah. We live in a world where those that don't believe in HaKadosh Baruch Hu and in Briyas HaOlam believe in evolution. It's basically the establishment. It's in all the media. You'll find it in all the textbooks. They teach it in all the schools. There are some states where it's against the law to teach that maybe there's intelligent design. What are the scientists saying? This is not a science lesson. But what are they saying? They say that everything that you see in this world came about by gradual, accidental evolution. There was a gene mutation. They don't know how the first cell got there. But however the first cell got there, when it reproduced, they don't know how it reproduced either, but it reproduced, and somewhere along the line, there was a gene mutation. Gene mutation number one. Now, these things don't happen overnight, you know. So a million years later, there was gene mutation number two. But it just happened to be fit together like two pieces of a puzzle. And after many, many, many gene mutations, you got eyes, ears, a liver, lungs, birds got wings. They could lay eggs, they could nurse their babies, etc., etc. So you got everything. That's what, when you boil down what they are saying to you, everything came about by chance. And so when I discuss this, I say to people, before we discuss their so-called proofs, you first have to know that it's incredible. No human being who's unbiased and has a little common sense can possibly believe that the trillions times trillions of amazing things that we see in creation could have all come about by chance. It's just incredible. Rabbi Chanan brings a medrash in the first Maimar in Kovitz Ma'amorim. He brings a medrash that an Ovid Kechavim confronted Rabbi Akiva, and he said to him, "Mi bara es ha'olam? Who created the world?" And Rabbi Akiva said, "Hakadosh Baruch Hu." So the guy said to him, "Hareini davar borur. Show me a clear thing. Prove it to me." So he said, "Who wove your garment?" He said, "A tailor." He said, "Prove it to me." So he turned to his Talmidim, who was finished with him. He turned to his Talmidim and he said, "Kishem shehabeged meyid alo oireg." The same way that the garment testifies to the weaver. "V'habayis al habanai," and the house testifies to a builder. "V'hadeles al hanagor," and the door testifies to the carpenter. So the world testifies to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. You don't need to meet the tailor to know that your garment was made by a seamstress or a tailor. It didn't come off the sheep like that, if it's wool. It didn't fall off the flax plant that way, if it's linen. It was woven. Or that the house was built by a builder. You might not know who the builder is. You may have never met him. Or that the door was put in there by a carpenter. It didn't fall off the tree in that shape. It didn't have hinges on it when it came off the tree. It was cut to shape by a carpenter. So the world and all its complexities testify to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So I have only a little bit of time left, and I won't keep you people too late, but I want to share with you a few examples that I tell people about this before we even get to discussing the so-called proofs, which I won't have time for tonight. And that is, if a person is walking in the desert and he discovers 10 stones in pyramid formation, 4, 3 on top, centered, 2, and 1, all of approximately the same size and shape, what is the first question that they ask? Who put it there? And they do not entertain the thought that maybe there was a sandstorm which just happened. Anything can happen. Given enough time, anything can happen. That maybe the sandstorm just happened to deposit 10 stones of equal size and shape in pyramid formation. If I take out my wallet and the papers fall out, and you notice that among my papers is a counter check, a check that you have to fill in all the information, not a printed check, a pre-printed check. You fill in your bank number and your account number and so on. And you notice that it's filled out, it's made out to me from your account on your bank with your signature. And you say, Rabbi Saperman, $5,000 check? I never wrote this check to you. Where did you get this from? I say, you know, I was just going to tell you. This counter check was sitting on the table next to an open bottle of ink, and the ink bottle spilled over, and it just happened by chance to write out these words. There's no way, no matter how credible you thought I was before, no matter how honest you know me to be, there's no way you'll accept it. You'll say, this is a lie. It could never stand up in a court of law either. But the scientists want us to believe that the most complex organisms and systems, like your respiratory system and your circulatory system and your digestive system and the brain, all came about by accident, by sheer accident. Every creature is tailor-made for its existence. We sat in our daughter's home on a Shabbos, and we heard, she lives a few blocks away from us in Toronto, and we heard, peck, 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 peck. A woodpecker. So I said to myself, what would happen if I would be doing this for 20 minutes? Peck, 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 on a tree. Even if I had an iron shield on my nose, I didn't get my nose hurt. What would happen to my brain? It would look like applesauce. The woodpecker has a special mechanisms in its brain that allows it to do what it does, because it was created to be a woodpecker. So it's got the claws to hang on the tree, perpendicular to the tree. It's got the beak that can peck into the bark of the tree and find its food. We went down. We have a son living in Miami. My parents are buried somewhere in Florida. That's the last place where they lived. And we went to the Beis Olam, and my son says, you know, we're right near the Everglades. Why don't we take a little tour? I'm all for it. So we go on one of these airboats that skims across the surface of the water. The water is loaded with alligators, and the boat stops at an island where they give you a demonstration about alligators. So we come in. There's somebody, attendant, is holding a baby alligator. You can touch. There's no harm. The bottom of the baby alligator, his skin is like silk. Like silk. The top has the bumps that you're all familiar with. So maybe if you, like me, you thought that these bumps were made to make alligator shoes and pocketbooks. But they told us the alligator remains submerged in the Everglade water all day, and that water is very cold. The alligator is a cold-blooded animal. So if it remains in the cold water, it won't be able to survive. Each of those bumps is like a battery that soaks up solar energy and keeps the alligator warm while he remains submerged under the water waiting for his prey. Then we went inside, and the demonstrator, who didn't have all of his fingers on one hand, He's holding the jaws of a gigantic, a monstrous alligator. He says the alligator has pressure in its jaws to open up at about 20 pounds per square inch, and a human being has more power in his hands, so I can easily hold the jaws of the alligator closed. Then he lets go, and the alligator opens up wide, and he runs his hand across, and the alligator shuts his mouth as fast as you can possibly imagine, and he just misses him. And he says, but he has 1,000 pounds of pressure to close his jaws, because that's what he needs to do to kill his prey. The alligator was created to live the existence of an alligator. He's custom made, tailor made. We went to a simcha and we came home on the plane. I'm not much of a moviegoer, but the plane was so tiny, so small. It was narrow, it was tight. It was a big plane, but it was very little space. And every seat had on it a television screen. And the gentleman in front of me was leaning all the way back. I didn't have enough room to open a sefer. So what am I supposed to do? So I said, if you can't beat him, join him. Maybe there's something on here that's worthwhile seeing. And you know what? There was. There was a National Geographic film about the snakes that curl themselves at the gigantic snakes like the anaconda or the boa constrictor that coil themselves around their prey, squeeze it tight, and then swallow it whole. So among many other things that they said, they did an experiment. And they put wires on the body of the snake in a cage, and they sent in an unfortunate duck, and the anaconda was very happy to do haknasas orchim. He seemed delighted when the duck came in. The duck didn't look as happy about it, and he coiled himself around the duck and he started squeezing, and they're measuring how much pressure this snake has in the muscles of its body to kill its prey. And they're showing you a graph that's going up and up and up and up and up. And then they show you a picture of a school bus. The animal has as much pressure in its body muscles to squeeze its prey as if a school bus were lying on top of that poor little duck. Now the question is, it kills much bigger things than this duck. And it swallows them whole. How does it get its jaws open wide enough? Well, all other animals, their jaws are on a hinge. The anaconda's jaws are on a track. When it gets here, it opens like this. The anaconda was made to be an anaconda. And if you follow this principle through, you'll see that every plant and every bird and every animal was tailor-made for its existence. If you go in the forest, the leaves have been falling every fall in the forest for, who knows, it's an old 100 years. You ought to have an accumulation up to who knows how high. You shouldn't be able to walk through the forest. Why not? Why isn't there? Because everything in nature disintegrates. Everything in nature disintegrates and goes back to where it was. That's why they have to have landfills for artificial things, for styrofoam and for plastic, because it doesn't disintegrate. Everything in nature, it's just a system. Every bird lays an egg which has a shell with a different thickness than other species. Because the shell has to be the exact thickness that it shouldn't be too thick for the baby chick to peck its way out, nor should it be too thin that it would be crushed and smashed under the pressure of being laid. So every bird has an eggshell, lays an egg with an eggshell that's just the perfect thickness. Not too thick and not too thin. The bees pollinize the trees. Do you know that the bees have sacks on their legs and brushes to brush off the pollen into the sacks? They also have a factory inside of them. Nectar, they collect nectar. Nectar evaporates rapidly, so they have a factory in their body that manufactures a chemical that they inject into the nectar and it turns into honey. And honey doesn't evaporate rapidly. The apple, Rabbi Avigdor Miller, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, was one of the first people who wrote at length about this subject in his books. I advise everybody to read them. I called him once to thank him for putting me on my feet in Emuna. I read his first book when I was 19, Rejoice, O Youth. And Rabbi Avigdor Miller always spoke about the apple. I'm only telling you a few things. The apple, like every other fruit, gets its best color when it's ready to eat. Before it's ready to eat, it has a color which is less lustrous, less conspicuous, so the people won't take it. And before it's ready to be eaten, you know how hard it is to pull an unripe apple off the tree? A ripe apple pulls off easily. An overripe apple falls off automatically. It's a perfect system. The peach pit is the hardest wood in the entire peach tree. You cannot saw it. You cannot saw across a peach pit. Inside the peach pit is the seed to reproduce another tree. Around the peach pit is a seam.